We're going to cover a lot of ground in a short amount of time. Welcome all attending the class. A special welcome to the Fort Lewis class. Professor Richard is hooking up her class and doing, it's a partnership we have where she's using some of our lectures and she'll have some of our own. And now that I know she's out there, I'll be able to tap her expertise for things that we have going on this year. Students, a reminder, I need you to have your cameras on during the class. I appreciate that. That way I know you're paying attention. You're here with us since a big part of your grade is attending. I will try to stop for questions every now and then, but if there is a question that you have as I'm going through this, put it in the chat box. I have staff that will be looking at the chat box, and they can either interrupt me or we can wait until we have a stopping point. So to me, this is one of the most exciting lectures of the season because I am a lawyer. I tell people I'm a recovering lawyer. And we are, and it's about the laws that have been created, the different administrations of water law, both at state, federal, and international level. We're just going to talk about a treaty with Mexico, because I probably won't have time to go into more international law. But this is, I love these pictures, the postage stamp of John Wesley Powell, who explored the Colorado River. If you have not read his diary, it is the most interesting thing to read. I took it with me. I did my own trip in the Grand Canyon and took it with me. And it was fun to read his passages about where he was. And then there's Harper's Weekly. I love the fact.
Yeah. Jennifer, I'm so sorry to interrupt. Are you wanting to be sharing your screen right now?
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
Have you got it?
Yep. Looks good.
All right. Thank you. I apologize. See, I get excited about this conversation. It's so much fun. The other one is the Harper's Weekly, and it just shows farmers at an irrigation ditch opening it up. So those are fun slides, in my opinion. So recall last week we talked about the Colorado Constitution and the fact that the prior appropriation doctrine is laid out in the Constitution. The water of every natural stream, not heretofore appropriated, is declared to be the property of the public and is dedicated to the public subject to appropriation as hereinafter provided. So that is, I mentioned last week, the Colorado Doctrine. Colorado really kind of started this movement of how to, this first in time, first in right, you can use your water off channel, and it was in the Constitution. It's in the Constitution of many Western states. So there are several requirements under the prior appropriation doctrine. Of course, the most important and the most valuable is that if you have a high priority, then you get the ability to use that water first if there's a shortage. But you have to put that water to beneficial use, and you cannot waste the water, nor can you speculate on that water. And we're going to talk about speculation later in the semester because there was a panel appointed in Colorado to discuss that exact issue. You can use the water off channel and you can transfer the water, but transfers are conditioned on you not harming the regime of the river. So if you were farming and you had and you applied water to your crops, then there was a certain amount of return flows that went back to the river. So it, as a farmer, if you decide to sell your water, let's say to the city of Denver, you have to make sure that the stream still holds the water it would have in the amount of this in stream flows. So that's protecting the regimen of the river. And then the right can be forfeited or abandoned for non-use. Every 10 years, the state engineer puts out a list of water rights that have not been used and could be abandoned.
Jennifer, we had a question on that last slide.
Sure.
Dixie asked, are there any streams or rivers technically not appropriated in Colorado?
Actually, the slide before this one.
Sorry.
No worries. There's a lag time.
That's a good question, Dixie. I think there are some, but they're probably high mountain streams. But that's an important note. We are using a lot of water. So the early beneficial uses, the traditional beneficial uses were ranching, industry, and irrigation. But the doctrine of prior appropriation was a little constraining. And it's, you know, everybody was taking water out of the river. By the way, in the early days, you couldn't appropriate the water unless you had taken it out of the river. And so everybody is drawing water out of the river. Well, that's not good for the river. And in the late 60s and early 70s, the public began to think and decide that rivers were important, ecosystems were important, and we needed to figure out a way to protect those systems. And so the definition of beneficial use has expanded to in-stream flows, to fishing, to kayaking. Power use was always a beneficial use. So the point here to me is that the doctrine of prior appropriation expands as required by the public, and that the prior doctrine has been tweaked here and there in Colorado, and I'll give you some examples as we go through here, so that it's a living document, but it's the very framework of a water right, and a water right is a property right. So it's very important in my mind that we keep that framework. So there are several administration systems in the West. As I mentioned last week, Colorado is the only state that has a water court. Now, that it, once this constitution was passed, the legislature, the next two terms of the legislature, decided that the only way you could protect your water right was to make a filing in court. So that's required. It was required then. We've tweaked a little bit the system in 1969, but you still need to get a court decree to protect your water right. Other states have a permit system where you first go to an agency, a state agency, and get a permit, and then you can protect that water right through different administrative type proceedings. Some of these states have a combination. Washington, Oregon, and California kind of have a combination of this. So our water, our state engineer is essentially, and he doesn't like to be called this, but he is like a water cop. He is the one who administers the water rights. If you're a senior water right and you're not getting your water, it's the state engineer's office you call and say, I'm putting a call on the river and I want my water. Then an employee will go out and make sure, you know, talk to the juniors, close their head gates if necessary, and make sure that you get your water. So state engineer is part of the Division of Water Resources, and that also takes care of well permitting, metering, well construction, dam safety, and data information. If you ever want to find water information on water in Colorado, go to the Division of Water Resources data information. They have tons of data that you can pick up. So in Colorado, there are 7 water divisions, and there is a division engineer who works for the state engineer in each one. We have the Platte River, we have Arkansas River, we have the Rio Grande, San Luis Valley. Then there's the lower Colorado River, so that's I can't remember, the La Plata and et cetera. Then we have the Gunnison area for the Colorado River, then the Upper Colorado River, and Division 6 is the Yampa Green River. Besides division engineers, all of our water courts are also located, one in each one of these divisions. Division 1 here, our water court is in Greeley, Colorado. And these judges aren't special trained. They're district court judges that have been appointed. And when they get there, their boss, the Supreme Judge, will say, I think you're going to do all the water court cases. So one judge does all the water court cases as well as the rest of his docket. But this then allows that person to become familiar with the laws, to become familiar with the engineering, and to be most useful for water court situations and for water rights. But really, water's managed at the local level. And we're gonna hear about that a little bit this semester. Talked about the division engineers. There are 4 water conservation districts in the state created by statute. There's the Southwestern District. There is the Colorado River District, Southeastern District. And I believe I'm not sure what the 4th one is. I want to say Republican. We have water conservancy districts here in our area. Northern Water Conservancy District is the big one, but they're located all around the state. Irrigation districts, then all these mutual districts, water users associations, 700 water utilities, and over 100 water and sanitation districts. Those are the people that get the water to you, treat the water, And when you turn on your tap, those are the people you want to thank. But you all know this one. Sometimes it's too local. Whiskey's for drinking, water's for fighting. It's some people say it was Mark Twain, although nobody can prove that who said that. But it's just that's a classic shot there, and I wanted to share that with you.
Jennifer, Matthew asked, I think on the last slide is what this is about, conservation versus conservancy districts.
Okay, yeah. Conservation districts they essentially do the same thing as conservancy districts, but they're created differently. And the conservation districts are specifically created under statute. So there's a statute that creates the Colorado River District. And it is the county commissioners who appoint the directors for those districts. The water conservancy districts, is a general statute talking about water conservancy districts. And those districts then formed under that statute. And those districts then, the judges, the water court, no, not the water court, any, the judges in the district appoint the members of that board. It's really fascinating. They kind of have different laws and a different way that they do things, but they're all big players in Colorado. And thank you for the questions. I appreciate you interrupting me to get that. So here's an interesting little factoid in Colorado. We do have groundwater. And I just love this. But we have three kinds of groundwater. We have tributary groundwater. We have non-tributary groundwater. And we have not non-tributary groundwater. Now, you just gotta love people who put these words together. So the tributary groundwater, of course, are those aquifers that are connected to the running water and streams and rivers. Non-tributary aquifers are those that have no connection to any of the surface water. The not non-tributary aquifers are the Denver Basin aquifers. There's four, I think, in that area. We call them the Denver Basin aquifers. And they have, by statute, they have special rules as to how you can use, how much water you can use at any time. Also, we've created groundwater districts in some areas, like the High Plains area has several groundwater districts. And then those are managed on a more local level. And you have to permit with a state engineer, but they have more of a local management and they have different rules that they follow. So they don't have to follow prior appropriation. The tributary groundwater does. So one of the tweaks that was made to the prior appropriation doctrine happened in 1973. There was a lot of late 60s, early 70s, as I said before, a lot of conversation about, are we protecting our environment? Are we protecting the ecostream systems? And no, we're not. And so what are we going to do about it? And so the law then was changed where you did not have to divert water to obtain a water right. And that's an in-stream flow. The General Assembly recognized the need to correlate activities of mankind with a reasonable preservation of the natural environment. The hook, though, is that only the Colorado Water Conservation Board has the authority to own in-stream flow rights. And those rights, when they obtain those rights, they are administered through the prior appropriation system. Now, we've gotten better at this and have looked at ways to increase in-stream flows or help them along in drought years. And so there's a program where you can essentially land your water right to, you know, if you're a farmer and it's a drought and you know you're not going to use the water, you can lend that water to the in-stream flow. And it's one way to help these streams survive in this severe drought. Then we went another step and we have what's called recreational in-channel diversions, or RICDs. These are, and that's Fort Collins RICD. This is for governmental entities can hold this kind of water right. The beneficial use is recreational, kayaking and rafting. And you don't have a diversion in the river, but you do have to have in-channel structures to control the flow of the river. So again, a evolution of our prior appropriation doctrine. Let me stop there and see if there are any questions at this point.
So in order to fall under the current slides, information, it doesn't seem like you'd have to have constructed structures to kayak. Do you have to have built some sort of recreational park in order to do this? Or
you've
is
got,
this natural?
No, you've got to put something in the river. So that, you know, they use rocks. They create a kayak course using whatever material, but that's required. Otherwise, it's an in-stream flow, and only CWCB can only in-stream flow.
So you can just go manipulate existing large stones to create a better situation for whitewater kayaking, and that would be considered adequate?
If you are an entity, and Fort Collins, all of them have done this, you have to go to CWCB and essentially, get them to approve your in-channel diversion. And CWCB has an administrative open meeting, essentially, where they explain what they're doing, how they're going to manipulate the water, how much water they need for that. And that's usually a bit controversial about how much water is actually needed for the course. And then if the CWCB approves it, then you go to water court and you get your in-stream flow, or you get your RICD. So there's an interesting history to this, CJ. I don't have time to go into it, but give me a call sometimes and I'll let you know about it, because it deals with Fort Collins also.
I will. Thank you.
You bet. So then we had our water quality laws, again, the 70s. The river you see there is the Platte River around Denver. That's a 1972 picture. Dire straits. We needed to figure out how to clean that up. And so the legislature passed the Water Control Act to protect, maintain, and improve the quality of water for public consumption, protection of wildlife and aquatic life, and for domestic, agricultural, and industrial and recreational uses. This has been an important law. We have the Water Quality Control Commission from CDPHE, Colorado Department of Health and Environment, houses that commission in the water quality section. And they're the ones who issue permits, and they're essentially the ones who make sure that people are paying attention and following the law. The interesting thing about the water quality law here is that it's conditioned on no material injury to water rights. What that means and how that works has evolved through the decades, and it's still sometimes a point of contention. But you have to have that water quality protection. However, you notice the prior appropriation system doesn't say anything about water quality. So there's nothing in your water right about water quality. But there are other federal laws that have come into effect that help protect that water quality, regardless of the prior appropriation system. Let me stop there. Any other questions?
I have a question.
Sure, go ahead.
And I know it may not be easy to answer, but so are these acts that were added on later, I guess, do they just encourage compromise with senior water users in times that conservation is needed, or do they kind of overrule like a call on the river?
No, they don't overrule it. What they are tools. if you're a rancher and you're interested in helping out the river, you've been given the tool to do that. And so it's neither encouraged or discouraged, in my opinion, but we have worked hard over the last, since I've been in this 35 years, we've worked really hard to be able to balance the needs of the ecosystem and the needs of the water users who use it for consumptive use. And so there have been lots of different tweaks, that I call them, that have come in to our system and help us meet that. The federal government helped a lot with looking at water quality, and I'll get to that in a minute, Dixie. So,
thank you.
You're welcome. So this is the United States Supreme Court, a picture of, and we need to talk about federal law and how that applies to water in Colorado. And we have federal reserved water rights, wild and scenic, safe drinking water. And I'm going to finish up talking about interstate compacts, equitable apportionments, and our international treaty with Mexico. So in 1908, the United States Supreme Court said that if a tribe has been put on a reservation, they also get water to sustain that reservation. This is called the Winters Doctrine. Very, very innovative. It had been talked about for a decade before, but as we put these tribes on those reservations, they had to have some way to survive. And we wanted to make them farmers at the time, so they needed water to farm. That doctrine, though, has gone beyond just farming. And Arizona Supreme Court has talked about that they get enough water to establish their homeland, essentially. So that would be water for industry, water for municipalities, et cetera. In 1963, the Supreme Court then applied that same law or same thinking to lands that have been set aside. So forests, Bureau land management lands, parks, all of it. And so those also have a reserved water right for the intended purpose of the reservation. And there's lots of litigation out there about what's the intended purpose of a forest, for instance. So there's a bunch of federal agencies dealing with water issues. Here's just a smattering of them. The ones that I've dealt with most of Reclamation, Department of Interior, Fish and Wildlife Service, EPA, NRCS at the Department of Ag, Army Corps of Engineers, USGS, Forest Service, and NOAA. NOAA here for us, we don't deal with so much in Colorado. They have charge of like the salmon on the coastal areas. So one of the laws that created a lot of attention was the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act of 1968. This act then allowed the government to set aside rivers, preserve those rivers with outstanding natural, cultural, and recreational values in a free-flowing condition as designated by Congress. So Congress has to pass a law designating a river as wild and scenic. Then you have protection against bank and channel alterations. It is a federal reserved water right for that in Wildland Scenic River. And, you know, we have like 209 rivers in 40 states that are designated wild and scenic, and they're still coming. It's usually a congressman in a certain state that puts it up and tries to move it through Congress. However, we in Colorado have only one wild and scenic river, and that is the Cache Lapoudre. 76 miles, designated in 1986. There has been attempts to move forward a wild and scenic river in other parts of the state. And there is especially hard work at the Upper Colorado River, headwaters of the Colorado River, to look at a wild and scenic designation. But the designation causes concerns for traditional water users. And what we found is that if you can bring people to the table, all who have an interest in that water, the consumptive use, the in-stream flows, the recreational, all of those uses, bring them to the table and figure out a way to protect that river without using the federal law. And then that allows for a flexibility on all sides of the aisle. And it's something that we try to, it's a way to manage the river. Now, some people don't like that. They think it should be a federal designation. One of the examples I have is from Senator Salazar. When he was in the Senate, asked for his historic designation of what was the name of the Dominguez Canyon. There we go. And he got that designation, but he put in the statute that the federal government would first work with the state under the state in-stream flow laws to protect that designation and to take care of what would be a federal reserved right and now becomes a state slash federal partnership. And I thought that was pretty ingenious on his part, because it forced all those interests to come to the table and figure out what was best for all. So that was one of the most interesting things that I was able to be involved with. So the National Environmental Policy Act of 1970, again, federal agencies have to give proper consideration to the environment when undertaking any major federal action that significantly affects the environment. That action could be lending money, that could be granting money. So any significant federal action. Then the agency has to prepare an environmental impact statement or an environmental assessment. And significant actions, as I said, include not only just building, but lending money. So when you hear, for instance, Denver is expanding Gross Reservoir, the Northern District is expanding their Windy Gap project. They had to do these environmental impact statements. They had to work with the Corps or Reclamation or whoever. And when I was first at this, in the 1990s, we had this adage that these environmental impact statements usually took 10 years and $10 million. Well, inflation has hit. They take a lot more time and they cost a lot more. The Trump administration tried to work up a a process where it would go through, where these things would go through faster. It seemed to help a little bit, but we'll see what happens with the Biden administration. Then we have the Clean Water Act of 1972, a pollution control program for waters of the United States. Sometimes you hear that referred to as WOTUS. It developed national water quality criteria. It requires NPDES permits, 401 permits for point source discharges. NPD, it means National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System. Also, it requires a 404 permit for any dredge or fill material that can be discharged into waters of the United States. Usually the 404 permit comes from the Corps of Engineers. States and tribes can assume responsibility of a program and require stricter standards if they so choose. Colorado does administer the 401 program through our Water Quality Control Commission. Also in 1992, the Supreme Court decided that this Water Quality Act also applies between states in a case called Arkansas v. Oklahoma. There are exceptions to the 404 permitting process, farming, ranching, and forestry activities. The picture you see there is the gold mine spill that happened several years ago. It was an EPA project trying to restore the area in the mine, and the wrong button was pushed, and we had a lot of polluted water that went down the river.
Jennifer, can I ask a question?
Yeah, let me stop there.
How often are those permits updated? For example, for farming exemptions, were those originally mandated in 1972 and they just have never been updated as fertilizers and other technologies have chugged along?
That's a good question. And I don't know. There are like nationwide exemptions issued through the Corps that restricts some things like pesticide use and some of that, but it's still, that is a sore point for many farmers that they see these other laws encroaching on what they consider their God-given right to that exemption. Same thing about non-point source pollution. And there's a big conversation going on about that. The large feedlots started being an issue with water quality. They are not exempted from 401 permitting. And so it just, again, it's a bit of an evolution, Brian.
Thank you.
Any other questions on that? Okay, I gotta move it here. Corps of Engineers, this is Chatfield Reservoir, south of Denver. They build dams, regulate flows of navigable waters, flood control projects, and they are the ones who issue the 404 permits for the state. Mike Connor is now head of the Corps. He was living in Colorado when he was appointed. So he's very well. He used to be the Commissioner of Reclamation in the Obama administration and Deputy Secretary of Interior. So we're in good hands. People know what they're doing with respect to those issues. I talked about WOTUS, Waters of the United States. I could do a whole hour on this conversation, but if you look for a definition of waters of the United States, it's a traditional navigable waters or interstate waters or other waters that could affect interstate or foreign commerce, impoundments of water, the U.S., tributaries and territorial seas and adjacent wetlands. This is an Upper Colorado River picture, a headwaters picture of wetlands. And so it's obvious that, you know, wetlands would be affected if you took water out of this river. The question becomes, what about beyond that? What kind of water needs to be regulated? An intermittent stream, a gully that only comes alive when it rains. There are a lot of talk about prairie potholes in the Midwest. Were they a water of the United States? The United States Supreme Court took on in several cases, tried to define waters of the United States. They failed and gave us a mishmash of direction. So each administration has tried to clarify what they think should be defined as waters of the United States. What is affected? Obama administration put in a set of rules. Trump administration canceled those rules, put in its own rules. And now the Biden administration has put us on notice that they're not going to go by the Trump rules. So it's a fascinating discussion. Again, I'd love to talk about it, and just give me a call and I'll give you more of on the QT. Then we have the Endangered Species Act of 1973 to protect threatened and endangered plants, animals, and their habitat. Fish and Wildlife Service out of the Department of Interior is in charge of the program. You have to get, for any action taken by the federal government, you have to have an analysis for a biological assessment saying, how is this action going to affect these endangered and threatened species? And then the Fish and Wildlife Service has to issue a biological opinion. The four species you see at the bottom there are the whooping crane. These are all in the Platte River. The pallid sturgeon, the piping plover, and the Preble's prairie mouse, jumping mouse. And those are all endangered in the Platte River. There is a program put together with the federal governments, Wyoming, Nebraska, and Colorado, that works hard to protect these species as we look at different things that are going on the river. Bureau of Reclamation, I've mentioned, it was established in 1902 with the mission to reclaim or develop the West. Lots of dams here and all in the West. There's several interesting novels out there about Bureau of Reclamation. Mark Reisner's Cadillac Desert is the one that most people seem to like to read. It talks about the development of the West through these different reservoirs and systems. Also, one of the reasons we created conservation and conservancy districts is in order to contract with the Bureau of Reclamation. And you have to get approval of Congress before a project moves forward. Here for us, the Colorado Big Thompson Project is the big one. And you essentially borrow the money from the Reclamation Fund and have to pay off a certain piece of that project. Reclamation is also a power provider. I want you to notice that this is Grand Coulee is on the right-hand portion in Lake Mead. Hoover Dam is on the left-hand portion. And you see that bathtub ring. You hear about Colorado River in drought. You hear about Mead and Powell, their lakes elevation declining. That was taken 10 years ago. It's worse now. And I couldn't find a picture recently, but hopefully we'll have a chance later in the session to talk more about Colorado River. So with interstate rivers, you're going to have states arguing about who gets what of the river. And there are three ways under our law that can be determined. You can have direct legislation by Congress. It's only been done once. You can file an original action in the United States Supreme Court. The Supreme Court then holds court, essentially, but it doesn't do it itself. It appoints a special master, and that special master is the judge. And he takes all the evidence. He looks at all issues. He looks at equitable apportionment. That's the legal term for how they divide the river. And then makes a decision. And everybody goes to the Supreme Court and they argue about the special master's decision, and the Supreme Court decides. The easiest way to go, and it's not that easy, but the easiest way to go is using the compact clause of the United States Constitution, where states can compact under, usually with the approval of Congress. We have, and by the way, a Colorado native from Greeley, Colorado, is the one who thought up this idea. And there's a great book about him. It's called The Silver Fox of the Rockies. And I highly recommend it. And of course, his name skips my brain just right now.
Delphus Carpenter.
Thank you. Delphus Carpenter. Thank you, Brian.
From CSU.
No, he was from Greeley, and he was a water lawyer, and the book about him is a CSU professor wrote the book, Silver Fox of the Rockies, and it's very interesting about how he came, you know, he knew that states would have a hard time litigating every single river. And so he thought about the compact clause. He convinced the other states and the federal government to put together a compact commission. They met in Santa Fe, New Mexico for a week and hashed out the Colorado River Compact. And so that's, again, another story that's great. But we have 9 interstate compacts here. You can see them on the slide. Then the last thing I wanted to mention is that affects Colorado is the International Water Treaty with Mexico on the Rio Grande, Tijuana, and Colorado rivers. And the United States is required to deliver a certain amount of water to Mexico on the Colorado River, and Mexico delivers to the United States on the Rio Grande. Because of the drought, there have been a lot of talk about how to meet this treaty obligation and whether or not there are ways to manage the river, even under the treaty. And several agreements have been made to allow Mexico to take some shortages, as well as the other lower basin states taking shortages. And so we saw in the last 20 years, this age of cooperation among the states, the federal government, Mexico states, and the NGOs who were very interested in keeping the Colorado River alive in Mexico. And in fact, a few years ago, we had a flushing flow that left the United States and went through Mexico. And actually, the Colorado River then did connect to the Delta. For the first time in many decades, essentially. So again, great stories behind this, but I want to stop there. And I know I've taken a lot of time, but it was a lot to share. And let's see if I can stop sharing. There we go. Are y'all back? Okay. So that was the whirlwind view of Colorado and federal law with a little bit of international treaty thrown in. So I'm going to stop there and see if any of you have questions. Gigi, if you guys have questions, wave or something and let us know. So. Oh, that was that clear. Oh, that's great.
I have a question.
Sure, Brad.
The Colorado River Compact was based off of data taken at Lee's Ferry in the early 1910s, 1920s. Yep. And obviously those numbers are no longer sustainable, and it seems like there's a kind of a big fight coming. Do you foresee potentially the compact being redrawn potentially, or do you think it'll just be more just interstate agreements instead?
I see it being interstate agreements. You know, the reason we in Colorado and in the Upper Basin entered into the compact was because we saw the Lower Basin developing more and faster. And it was a way for us to protect our piece of that pie. Now, our piece of that pie has gotten smaller due to climate change. Brian, you might be interested. There's a book out there called Science Be Damned, where Eric Kuhn and John Fletcher wrote that from what they saw, there was evidence at the time that there wasn't that much water in the river on a regular basis. And so it leads to a discussion of what science do you use, and then how does policy play into that science role? Thanks for the question. That's great. Anyone else?
Oh yeah, I just had another question, kind of to see your side and your input, and just your personal opinion. You talked about the different administration systems for water law, and how Colorado is the only state with an exclusively exclusive water court. What are the pros and cons, and what do you see as the stronger system between the water court and the permit systems?
So glad you asked. So I started my law career in Wyoming, permit system. You adjudicated your water right through an administrative board. And it was Elwood Mead, who was Bureau of Reclamation, and Lake Mead is named after him, was an assistant state engineer in Colorado and didn't like the way Colorado was doing it. So he went to Wyoming and started up the permit system. I was so bold when I first came to Colorado out of Wyoming to tell people that the permit system was a better system. Boy, did I get an earful. So there are pros and cons to each of the system. I still favor the permit system because until really recently, anybody could get a permit and could adjudicate a permit. You didn't have to have lawyers and engineers. You know, as our water supplies have gotten shorter, as managing water has become more complicated, you really need those kind of experts there. Thanks for the question. That's great.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for sharing. That's really interesting. I was just curious your opinion.
Anyone else?
I had a question on cloud seeding, because I remember it was a little controversial with ski resorts trying to seed clouds, and then people were upset that their clouds, the rain clouds, were getting stolen. So does that fall under the water law we talked about today under recreation, or is that
it doesn't
kind of
really fall under it, but it's really, Dixie, it's an interesting conversation. When the Upper Basin and Lower Basin were putting together drought contingency plans, the Upper Basin's first line of defense was cloud seeding. And actually, Metropolitan Water Agency in California and the Nevada Water Authority pay money to Colorado to do cloud seeding. Wyoming recently, about 5 years ago, came out with a report showing how cloud seeding did increase stream flows. The question is how much? You know, are you getting the bang for your buck? There still is and continues to be people who fear that, you know, there's only so much water in the atmosphere. And if you're moving it here to the mountains, what about these guys on the plains? Are we putting them at risk? Are they at risk for more hail if we're taking up that water? So that's a continuing conversation, Dixie. And that's about all I know about it at this point.
Thank you.
Anyone else? You guys ask great questions. Go ahead, CJ.
About the wild and scenic rivers and the Poudre River being the only one we have in Colorado.
Uh-huh.
Your slide said that it provides protection against bank and channel alterations. Are there a series of other protections that are also included in that?
Well, it essentially, yes, it provides protection for the flows.
So I feel like I've, you know, been on the Poudre River whenever we're heavily diverting and rainfall is sort of tapered off maybe. And it seems that our flows get extremely low at times. Is that whenever we see it get very, very low, are those naturally low flows or would they be higher if we weren't diverting from the river? And are we currently satisfying, you know, year in and year out our free flows that we are supposed to be through this act?
So that's a great question. Now, you get a reserved water right as of the date of the legislation that approves the wild and scenic designation. The Poudre River was 1976. There were a whole lot of rights before 1976 on the Poudre River that have senior priority. And so they have the ability to continue to withdraw that water. What a person can't do is change their water right to withdraw the water in the middle of the wild and scenic portion. And so it's a good thought, but we have to, water rights on the Poudre probably started getting established in the 60s and 70s, 1860s, 1870s. And so it's just the way that system is at this point, which is one of the reasons I argue for bringing everybody to the table and figuring out a way to manage it where people might be more willing to agree to not defer it at certain times of the year sort of thing.
Just to clarify that federal water right that's supposed to maintain the free flow is still subject to the hierarchy of seniority?
Yes. Yes. Thank you. I didn't make that clear. So the Federal Reserve water rights are work into the prior appropriation system. Tribes on Colorado River are threatening to many of the states because, for instance, the Navajo, their reserved water right hasn't been adjudicated yet. So no judge or the Congress hasn't said, this is how much water you get. And they're a big reservation and they could be due a lot of water. And so that's another conversation that goes on in the Colorado River. With us, our Ute tribes, we settled, we had a water right settlement with them in 1988. And so they have their established reserved water rights. And I believe that the agreement meshes those in some way with the prior appropriation rights. I can't remember the specifics of it, but yeah, so.
Thank you.
You bet.
Did you say that for the non-tributary aquifers that they don't have to follow the prior appropriation laws? And I guess, what do they have to follow?
So there is a groundwater statute that provides how that water is to be split up. They have local governing boards who then look to see, you know, can they sustain the aquifer? How much can one person take? You know, you don't, in states like Texas, the groundwater under your land is your groundwater. That's not how it is here. And David, groundwater is one of my weak subjects. So I apologize. I don't have more to say about it.
Thank you.
Anyone else?
Actually, just kind of had a follow-up to CJ's question.
Sure.
Was it relatively, I mean, just in terms of logistics, because the wild and scenic designation ends around the Hewlett Gulch area, if I remember correctly.
Mm-hmm.
So is it just easier to the fact that there aren't that many diversions actually upstream between, say, what, Joe Wright Reservoir and that, and then Hewlett Gulch to the point where it's just easier to actually call that wild and scenic since there's no real opportunities otherwise to create that many diversions?
So
the is it just a matter of luck?
Wild and scenic on Cache La Poudre is a mishmash of designations and protections for that 76 miles. So part of, you know, some of those miles are sectioned off. That's wild and scenic, but this section is kind of the next level down from wild and scenic. And when that designation was made, there was a lot of conversations going on with Greeley, Fort Collins, Northern Water District about where those boundaries are, because of course, all of these municipalities in the district were trying to provide for future growth. And so it's really interesting if you just Google Cache La Poudre Wild and Scenic, it's a fascinating history, and it talks about the negotiations that went on with respect to it.
Thank you.
Well, you've all been great. Next week we have, or not next week, because that's a vacation. The next week, we have someone here from Fort Collins Water. I've asked her to talk about water quality sustainability for Fort Collins, what they're doing, what they're thinking about. And so I hope that you join us. Those of you who are not students that have been with us, thank you very much for your attention. I hope you all have a lovely evening. See you later. Bye-bye.